Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. $2.1 billion. That's the bottom line of the budget the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board approved this week, though not all are on board. Catholics here mourn the death of Pope Francis. New developments in the disagreement over how Cabarrus County commissioners replaced their outgoing chair. Airport workers push for higher wages. Anti-Trump protests break out. And we recap exactly where the Riggs-Griffin Supreme Court race stands at the moment. Here to talk about those stories and many more is WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for rollcall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
But we're going to start with the schools. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board voted to approve Superintendent Crystal Hill's $2.1 billion budget. And to fill us in on those details, we've invited WFAE's education reporter James Farrell to join us. James, the board members, three board members voted against this budget. Is that unusual?
Well, it is unusual. I think that in this case, the board generally agreed philosophically with the idea that teachers needed to be paid more, but they disagreed over how to get there. And ultimately, what this came down to was a disagreement over whether the school board should be asking for a higher teacher salary supplement, which is the amount of money that the county pays towards teacher pay. These three members wanted to ask the county for a higher number in order to kind of try to negotiate from there. And the number that was ultimately passed was 5%. So it was kind of unusual in the sense that they were all sort of on the same page. And when they went around the room and discussed this, they were all in agreement that teachers are not paid enough and that the state is in large part responsible for paying teachers and should be paying more. But it was a disagreement as to how to kind of move the needle on that.
So the three members who voted against this budget were Melissa Easley, Lisa Klein, and Summer Nunn. They've been debating this for weeks about whether the district should pursue more of an increase in their budget request so that teacher salaries can be raised. They all say the teachers are underpaid, but Melissa Easley argued that the budget's 5% increase for the county-funded teacher salary supplement is not enough to make up for shortcomings in state funding.
This means the burden falls more heavily on our local funding to make up the difference, which, let me be clear, is not something that should be happening, but these are the cards that we are dealt.
And Lisa Klein made the point that if you don't ask, you don't get.
The only thing somebody can say is no to your ask, but we're not even asking.
This is a part of the dance that we do every year, James, as you know, between the school board and the county and the state. So remind us, what are the sources of funding for our public schools?
Right. So when it comes to teacher salary in particular, most of that comes from the state. The state sets the base salary and sets the salary schedule. But the state also has a second supplement that most school districts across the state are able to give to teachers, except for four, and that includes Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, and that's based off of the size of our tax base. And then local counties can also add another supplement on top of that, and that's what's on the issue here, is this local Mecklenburg County-funded supplement.
So put this $2.1 billion number into some sort of context. What did we ask for last year?
Last year, it was, well, so a lot of times when we talk about this, we talk about from the operating budget perspective, which was $1.95 billion. That's a big majority of the budget. And this was a less than 1% increase from that. So it's only about $29 million more from the operating budget perspective than what was asked for last year.
And as Lisa Klein, we just heard her say, if you don't ask, you're not getting, and we're not even asking. Had they asked, if they asked, should they ask, are they likely to get it?
If they were to ask for a higher supplement, and I think that was part of kind of the sticking point here, is there was concern about whether that was going to be possible. Mecklenburg County has been talking about its own potential revenue shortfalls. Obviously, the school district has also been talking about the budget being tight with uncertainty around federal and state funding. So everywhere you look, budgets are tight right now, and I think that that was kind of the sticking point here in not going higher than that 5% ask. There was concern that they would not get that.
By most reasonable measures, the state has historically underfunded the public schools, and that's something that Board Chair Stephanie Sneed, who voted for this budget, mentioned. She believes that too much emphasis is being placed on the county supplement portion of their funding, and she doesn't want to let the state off the hook.
There is a tragedy that's happening, that there is money that taxpayers have already paid that is not coming from the state to support our school system.
Is she referring to the money that is being funneled into the Opportunity Scholarship Voucher Program? Is that what she's talking about?
She is referring to that, and as well as just other programs in general, and just the idea that not a lot of money is being funded to the state. You'll hear a lot of public school advocates talk about the fact that we are ranked 48th in school funding. We're also ranked pretty low in terms of school funding effort, which is school funding as a percentage of the state GDP. So I think that kind of in general is what she's referring to there, is sort of just the sense that there's not enough money that's coming, that there is money that's coming into the state coffers that's not then making it its way back to the school system. And certainly opportunity scholarships came up as part of that conversation as well.
Do we know how much money opportunity scholarships are siphoning away from CMS?
I'd have to check the number again. Okay. I'm not sure off the top of my head.
So CMS board vice chair, Dee Rankin, made a point of thanking Mecklenburg County. There's often a cantankerous relationship with the school board, or at least there has been between the school board and the county. She thanked them for their support in the last several budget cycles and also said it is time to hold the General Assembly accountable to do what they've been charged to do, she said, which is fund public education. Does CMS make an ask to the state for funding, or do they merely incorporate into their funds what the state decides to give them?
Yeah, they incorporate into their funds what the state decides to give them. And this year they have planned for about a 3% increase in state-driven salary increases. That was actually also another sticking point from one of the board members who voted no. Lisa Klein had said that the board's legislative agenda calls for an 8% increase, meaning that the board is hoping to lobby for 8%. And she thought it didn't really match up that they were saying that they were going to lobby for that, but then planning for something that was much smaller than that. And she said, well, what if we get our ask? How do we adjust the budget accordingly? And obviously that would be a good problem to have, but, you know, how do we do that? And also just kind of a sense that the ambition of the budget should match the ambition of the legislative agenda.
So this budget calls for an average, correct me if I'm wrong on these numbers, because there's all these numbers floating around, 5% pay increase for teachers funded by the county on top of the assumed 3% increase from the state. If I did the math right, that's 8%. I don't know many people who get an 8% raise in a year after getting a raise in a previous year. How is this justified?
Well, teachers are still, there's still a lot of debate about whether teachers are paid enough, and especially here in Mecklenburg County. And that really was the biggest concern here, is that the cost of living in Mecklenburg County is very high. And Stephanie Sneed pointed to the fact that 19,000 teachers have left their position over the last, I think it's over the last year was the number that she was citing. So there's definitely a lot of concern about teacher retention. Starting salary for a teacher in their first year of teaching at the state level is $41,000. Mecklenburg County is another, I think, $7,000 adds on top of that from their local supplement. And then, of course, Mecklenburg County does not get that state-supplied supplement, which has been another point of contention for members on the board, and something that Superintendent Crystal Hill has called attention to as well. So there's still a sense that even with those increases, it's not enough to support teachers living and working in this county.
It would be hard to do that in this county at that level. Of course, the Trump administration has already made severe cuts to the Department of Education, whose job it is to help fund schools, not to control curricula, as has been bounded about by people who are advocating for the demise of the Department of Education. And in fact, Trump is planning, if he goes through with his plans, to shut down that department. How is CMS planning for whatever may happen as a result of that?
So what we know at this point is that CMS is only allotting about 65% of its Title I funding. That's the federal funding that goes to schools based on the percentage of students from low-income families. That is to kind of try and create a cushion so that should there be any cuts, the schools are already prepared. Superintendent Crystal Hill said that money would go towards funding people-based positions right now and focusing on that. And then should all the funding come in, obviously, then you have more to work with. But this was actually another point of contention, too. Lisa Klein was frustrated that there was no contingency plan created by the district, like a plan B or a plan C or anything like that. She wanted to see kind of a more detailed plan as sort of an alternative should we lose all this federal funding. But what we have heard as well, what Hill said at the meeting was that they were concerned about doing that because federal funding is supposed to be supplemental funding. It's not supposed to supplant local funding sources. So she was actually concerned that this could almost look like a federal violation of law to try and like plan for how to replace money that's supposed to be supplemental funding. And moreover, she was also concerned about, we don't know if the Trump administration were to cut funding, we don't know if that's going to be all of it, if it's going to be 10%. So she was concerned about creating a contingency plan that would create a sense of panic that maybe jobs would be lost when in reality, we don't know the scale of what those cuts could kind of look like. So right now, just that 65% holdback of that Title I funding.
So the board approved $2.1 billion. Where does that budget go now?
Well,
what
the budget
next.
I mean, CMS has argued that the budget will now go to Mecklenburg County, which will look at the specific request from Mecklenburg County, which is around $667 million, and that of course includes that teacher supplement that we've been talking about here.
Well, we'll keep our eye on that in the weeks and months ahead. James Farrell, our WFAE education reporter, thank you for joining us this morning. Appreciate it. We're going to let
Thanks,
you
man.
Go and move on to people who know nothing about education. I'm just kidding. There are a couple of decisions that were handed down this week in the ongoing saga of the battle for the seat on the North Carolina State Supreme Court between incumbent Justice Democrat Allison Riggs and her Republican challenger, Judge Jefferson Griffin. We devoted an entire hour to this yesterday, and we would encourage you to listen to our podcast or catch up on it at our website at WFAE.org. But Steve, catch us up for this program. There are two moves that happened this week, one by Judge Griffin, the other by the Fourth Circuit Court. What happened?
Yeah, the biggest news is that a three-judge panel on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond put a stay on the North Carolina State Supreme Court's plan for some overseas and military voters to have to, quote, cure their ballots by sending in a copy of their photo ID. The Fourth Circuit put a pause on that. That is a victory for Allison Riggs, the Democratic incumbent. It looks like the Fourth Circuit is sending this dispute back to the U.S. District Court judge. So that's one track that this case is going on. The other is that there is a fight at the state level over which counties will be subject to the state court's ruling. The State Board of Elections, which has a Democratic majority, said we're only going to require voters in Guilford County, overseas and military voters in Guilford County, to send in a copy of their photo ID. The Griffin campaign said no, it needs to be five others. So we are coming up, Mike, on the 6 months anniversary since this election, and we are still weeks and weeks away from finishing.
And Ben, the numbers of ballots that the Griffin campaign wants to have counted keeps changing, sometimes because it's being changed for them, sometimes because they've asked for different numbers. I've seen anywhere from 1,500 to 1,600 to 1,400. How many ballots are in question at the moment? Do we know?
Well, as you said, it keeps on changing. And I would remind you and remind your listeners that this all comes down to a little over 700 votes from the November election. And as you all covered yesterday, but for folks who might not follow this as closely, I mean, there's already been two recounts. And they've noted that before that the ballots in question, I mean, they've been certified in every other race in from November. And so what's the precedent going forward? What does this mean for other races? If they're going to make a special occasion out of this, what do they do going forward? And I think that's sort of the crux of a lot of people's concern, Republican or Democrat.
Joe, I have 30 seconds.
Yeah, right now, the Guilford ballots are the only ones that the state board should be included right now, because they say those other protests didn't happen in time right now. If it's only the Guilford ballots that end up having to be cured, maybe it sorts out better for Riggs, but you know, when you add in those other Democratic counties, it gets a little more challenging.
And there's some implications that I do want to talk about this before we move on to other things, and we'll do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Joe Bruner, reporter for WSOC-TV, Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV, Steve Harrison, our political reporter at WFAE News, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist at RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Mary, we're talking before the break about the latest maneuvers in the Griffin Riggs case, which we talked about for an hour yesterday. But these maneuvers by the Griffin campaign and by GOP strategists in the state and in Washington appear to be, as we talked about yesterday, part of a roadmap. And if that plan is successful, it could have serious ramifications for election integrity, confidence in our election, confidence in our courts. Why, in your opinion, is one political party apparently so willing to risk all of this for what would be very little gain on an already Republican-dominated Supreme Court?
Well, as you made the point, it's pretty much a test case. In November 2024, we saw a lot of folks revving up on the Republican side in case Donald Trump had lost that race to challenge in every state the vote, particularly in the swing states. So we see now that this is a playbook. The way Griffin wants to cherry pick and just recount the votes in not just Guilford, but all of the six Democratic-leaning counties, because he knows that that would be to his advantage. So they're testing to see in future how many races can they contest on every level. So if the sense would be, if I win, I win. If the Republicans win, yes, we'll say we won. If the Republican loses, we will contest it in every court. We will drag it out. And we've seen these so-called election integrity groups, which mean everything but integrity, that are gearing up to have lawyers to try to contest it. This looks like it probably is going to go back to the federal courts. Riggs, I'm sure, believes that she has a better chance in federal courts, but it might even go up to the Supreme Court. And that's unpredictable, because that too has pretty much Republican-leaning judges on it, which we did not used to really always mention what kind of politician or what party of the politician appointed that judge. Now, more and more, you can kind of forecast what the votes will be.
So we'll be talking about this for the next year, probably. Catholics around the world find themselves mourning the death of Pope Francis this week, and that includes the 530,000 Catholics in the Charlotte Diocese. As with many, many pontiffs, his influence spread beyond the Catholic Church, but Pope Francis seemed to touch people in a more profound yet personal way.
He was wonderful, just very relaxed. He was jovial at times. He was very serious and compassionate at other times, depending on the topic that was being discussed, but incredibly approachable and open.
That's Bishop Michael Martin of the Diocese of Charlotte, who met with the Pope, I believe, last September. Another Charlottean, Claudio Bonas, emigrated from Argentina 20 years ago. That's the country where Francis was born, and we've translated his comments, but he spoke about why Francis's message about immigrants resonated with him.
The immigrant is a person who sometimes doesn't have many opportunities, so we have to build bridges, not walls. So it's another of his phrases that will make a difference.
So Mary, the last pope that I can remember that had this kind of impact on ordinary people and people of all faiths and people of no faith was Pope John the 23rd back in the Vatican Council days in the 1960s. And like Francis, he seemed to move the church forward. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think this pope, when Pope Francis was chosen, I believe many thought he would be just a caretaker pope for a while, but he ended up making a big mark. The first Jesuit, the first pope from the Americas, and he did reach out, you saw, particularly to children, to the disabled, to prisoners, to the immigrants and folks in society that were looked down upon. He also avoided the trappings of it, although he does live in Vatican City, there were many trappings, but the way he would, you know, lived in a small apartment. But it's also important to say that, as with any pope, he had his supporters and some detractors who thought when he spoke about things like immigration, like climate, that he was not being, you know, to progressives, he was not progressive enough. But to traditionalists, particularly in the United States, there was a lot of pushback against this particular pope. That's why they're all looking forward to see what will the next pope carry on this tradition. Or will they be, will the next pope be more traditional? He appointed most of the cardinals, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they will carry on Francis's legacy. But he did, you could see the crowds, the hundreds of thousands of people. They had to keep it open so they could view him because they felt moved by this particular pope.
And as you say, not everybody agrees with everything he tried to do or everything he said. That's not unnormal, I wouldn't think. He didn't exactly embrace LGBTQ people, but he did say, "Who am I to judge?" And WFAE's Julian Berger spoke with Bishop Martin last year about the Pope's support for justice issues like those swirling around the poor, around climate change, and the view that he was friendlier than his predecessors to the LGBTQ community.
One of his great gifts to us has been that focus on listening. And I've taken it to heart myself, and I hope it will be something that we will live out more deeply within the Diocese of Charlotte and around the world in the days, months, and years ahead.
As you say, he appointed many of the cardinals who will now choose his successor. He also expanded the College of Cardinals in a way to be more inclusive and representative of the church internationally, as opposed to just one part of the world. A lot of those cardinals are from Africa. Are they likely to choose somebody in the mold? We don't know, of course, but are they likely to choose somebody in the mold of Pope Francis or go in an entirely different direction?
We don't know. Many of those popes from the African continent are quite conservative, actually, when it comes to doctrine of the church. So it's really difficult to predict through our own political lens. We do know the church, let's face it, is still there will be no women cardinals there, you will notice. And the church is very much anti-abortion. And while he said that LGBTQ unions could be blessed, that people will not be getting same-sex marriages, will not happen in this church. But at the same time, these small steps did anger some traditionalists. But I feel that now that everything is political, everything is on the stage, will the next pope continue to speak out on things like the environment, like immigration, which really he had a clash with Catholic convert Vice President J.D. Vance on this, and he was very open about that. I think we will not know until we see that white smoke come up from the conclave.
And that will happen, one would presume, in the next few weeks.
Yes. The
recent elections of popes have not taken all that long, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it won't be as dramatic as the movie, I don't think.
No,
so.
not as dramatic as conclave. Nor will the funeral. The funeral takes place tomorrow in St. Peter's Square. It'll be broadcast by NBC on Channel 36 on WCNC at 4 a.m. Ben will be up because that's when he gets up.
But many mourn this pope. Let's leave it at that. He was controversial, but he will be missed.
Drew Cromer is the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party, but since November, some have been upset with him in the party because of the fewer Democrats in Mecklenburg County turned out to vote in November than the party had hoped. Of course, the outcome was always going to be close, but the Democrats lost the presidential race, and fewer Democrats also turned out for the election night party that the local Democratic Party held that cost $100,000. That has had, in the last several months, Democrats questioning the financial decisions being made under Cromer's leadership. And this Saturday, that leadership role is up for grabs. What's the story, Steve?
Yeah, this will be the county, the Mecklenburg Democratic Party convention. They will pick a chair for the next 2 years. Cromer is running for a second term, and he's being challenged by Wesley Harris, a former member of the state house from the Ballantyne area, who ran unsuccessfully for state office in November. And like you said, Mike, there was this turnout in Mecklenburg County has been a continual problem for the Democratic Party in North Carolina. Wesley Harris is saying he's now the guy to fix it. He's the guy to bring turnout up to the state level or beyond. Drew Cromer is pointing to some of the successes he had, most notably fundraising. They raised a ton of money in the last 2 years.
Yeah, they raised $2.8 million as opposed to $120,000, which I think had been the last fundraising attempt. That's a lot of money, $2.8 million.
It's a huge amount for a county party.
Yeah.
It is a staggering amount.
So You can't make people vote, Ben. It's unfortunate that people don't exercise their franchise because we may not have it that much longer. And you can't make people turn out for a celebration party, which could have been a big deal had Kamala Harris won, but she lost. Still, Josh Stein, the Democrat, won the governor's race in North Carolina. Jeff Jackson won the Democratic race for attorney general. And at the moment, Allison Riggs, the Democratic candidate for Supreme Court, won by 734 votes. So what decisions are Democrats questioning, Ben?
$100,000 on election night, the party. It comes down to that. I mean,
would
my
they
colleague
be questioning it had Kamala Harris won?
I believe no, but you want the top of the ticket. That's why they call it the top of the ticket. And you know, to his credit, Drew Cromer has told WCNC in the past that, you know, for the first time they had all this money. They had a lot of paid staff. They had volunteers. I think 200 events, 400,000 door knocks, 3 million phone calls, and a record outreach to Black and Brown communities. But a lot of those same communities, Black and Brown communities, have told us, and in our reporting, that he's not been very collaborative and not very inclusive. And so when you have that and you have the spending and you have the low voter turnout, I mean, there are more Mecs in Mecklenburg. I mean, there's more Dems in Mecklenburg County than anywhere else in the county. If you don't turn them out here, you're going to have a problem in any statewide election here.
Yeah. You mean there are more Democrats in Mecklenburg than anywhere else in the state, even Wake County?
I believe so. Really? Yes.
Okay. Mary.
Yes, and I was going to say, to follow up what Ben said, the friction between voters of color, Black and Brown voters, particularly Black voters in the Democratic Party, reflects a national debate that perhaps the Democratic Party is always going after voters that they have not gotten. And they don't pay enough attention to the base, which are the Black voters are the base of the Republic of the Democratic Party. Just as on the national scene, you hear many Democrats blaming Democrats leaning into identity politics, saying that Kamala Harris did that, when in fact she never talked about it. She was a woman who was South Asian and Black. To them, maybe that is her identity that's the problem. And you will hear that friction, that perhaps they don't appreciate these voters, they don't reach out to them, they don't really elevate their issues because they're going after voters that they really haven't gotten for a while. So what Ben said about the friction really is reflected, I think.
Let's talk briefly about that, Steve, because Drew Cromer is the chair and he's being challenged by Wesley Harris from Ballantyne, who has said that his opponent's time at the head of the party has been slightly polarizing, to say it lightly. That is a quote. Democrats nationwide have a lot of rebuilding to do in the aftermath of the last election. Is the Mecklenburg branch in any worse shape than any other segment of the party?
I don't think you could point to any particular problems unique to Mecklenburg County. I mean, I think, like you said, I think the national Democrats are going through a tough period. You know, there have been early this year, several polls nationwide had shown that the public opinion of the Democratic Party was at its lowest level in 25, 30 years, or since the beginning of, you know, whatever poll the pollster had asked this question. So I don't think there's anything particularly unique here, but adding to one thing that Ben said, part of this is Drew Cromer had hired before the election an executive director, and there were problems. The relationship didn't work out, and Drew Cromer had kind of demoted her leading up to the election. She was a Black woman. He's a white male, and there was a sense that he had not handled that situation well, and it's led to a lot of tension throughout the county party.
So let's stick with politics, but move it slightly north, Joe. Trouble continues in Cabarrus County over who will replace outgoing Chairman Chris Meesmer on the county commission. Remind us, some members of that five-person commission got together, and they named LaMarie Austin Stripling to fill his seat, and that is where the trouble began. Why?
A lot of things going on with this one. First of all, Chris Meesmer called the meeting at a time when one of the commissioners was receiving dialysis, so they already knew that he wouldn't be able to attend. He also participated in the meeting. The purpose of the meeting was to appoint somebody to take over for him yet he had not yet resigned from his seat on the Cabarrus Commission. And that's what the crux of the lawsuit really is here. They said that he had already been appointed to the state Senate, but he was still acting as a commissioner and he hadn't resigned, and they were voting on a vacancy that did not exist at that point.
And because of that lawsuit, this week a judge ruled that DeLaMarie Austin Stripling cannot be seated for the moment. So meanwhile, Cabarrus County Commission Vice Chair Jim Quick is urging the board to keep her in consideration.
Commissioners, I suspect each of you have a name that you may be wanting to advance. I encourage you during this pause, take the time and speak to DeLaMarie. We pledge that she is one of the best people that we've ever put forth for this commission.
He also said that contrary to conspiracy theories, the Republican Party's nomination of Stripling was ingrained in the goal of redirecting the commission away from division and toward a community of effectiveness. If that was the intention, why did they proceed in a way that looks, for the lack of a better word, sneaky?
That's a great question. She is the pick of the Cabarrus County GOP for this seat. I think there are a lot of politics at play on the commission. On one side, you have Meesmer, Laura Blackwell Lindsay, as well as Larry Pittman. And then on the other side, you have Kenny Wortman and Lynn Shue. So you got these two factions right now. It's 2-2 without Meesmer. And so I think that there are politics at play here, and both tribes, if you will, want to have that third member maybe vote more along their interests. And on the Wortman Shue side, I think they were they thought it was too quick, that, you know, they had 40 applicants to the seat and they should take the time to vet each one of them. And, you know, I think you could also make the case that, you know, this is a GOP seat. They're all GOP seats, but this right. is who the Cabarrus County GOP once appointed to the seat. Maybe should give consideration to that.
She can't be seated as long as the stay is in effect. What will raise that stay, and could this be resolved if the entire board, as it is presently comprised, got together and re-voted?
Yeah, absolutely. This could be a moot point if they just appoint her, or I think if they appointed somebody else, that would bring more litigation. But certainly, if they just voted on Monday to appoint her, this lawsuit would go away, because then you have the unanimous vote there. But in the meantime, I mean, I don't expect that to happen. Arguments are still going to be made. This lawsuit is pending.
Okay. When might it be resolved? Do you have any idea?
I don't have an idea. Next couple of weeks, I would assume.
There's another lawsuit I want you to talk about. I think it's a lawsuit. It involves Medic and Charlotte Fire. We'll talk about that when we come back. We'll also talk about the business outlook in North Carolina as laid out by the governor in light of what's happening in Washington when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News. Ben Thompson from WCNC-TV. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. And Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, also host of their Equal Time podcast. I misspoke a moment ago. It is not a lawsuit we're about to talk about. It is a contract impasse, Joe. And back we come to Mecklenburg County. Commissioners met Wednesday with the leaders of the county's towns and municipalities to try to find a solution to that impasse between Medic and first responders. What is this about?
Mecklenburg County pays or supplements the fire departments in Huntersville, Charlotte, Cornelius, so they can respond to medical calls. And these fire departments are saying, you know, listen, our workload is going up. We would like more money for responding to these calls. And the county manager has said, this is double taxation. We shouldn't be having to pay more money for you to do this. At the same time, Medic all the towns are saying Medic needs to respond to calls faster and provide more information and data about how long it is taking for them to respond.
So the contract deadline has already been extended. And according to Rusty Knox, who's the mayor of Davidson, it's expected to expire in Huntersville in July and in August for Cornelius. And Rusty says that if the contracts end, it will put a strain on resources.
When I'm waiting on an ambulance, I've got 8 firefighters that are on a shift, 4 on this truck, 4 on that truck. If my truck's waiting on an ambulance, I'm down 50%.
So right now, this county is divided into 3 zones for Medic, which some say is too large for proper response times. And in the northern part of the county, they want dedicated Medic crews stationed in that area. Is that practical or affordable?
I think you could find a way to do it. I don't know if you can find a way to do it in the next couple of months. But this, the complaints about response time in northern Mecklenburg County are not new. These have been long-standing issues there. And I think that's part of the reason why these fire departments are asking for more money, because they are picking up for where Medic can't get to these people as fast as they may want to.
And money is what is the crux of all this, I suppose. The county already sends $500,000 to the towns and to Charlotte for emergency services, as you mentioned. That leads to some people to believe or to call it double taxation. Among those people calling it that is Dina DiIorio, Mecklenburg County's manager. She says the towns and Charlotte already levy taxes to fund emergency service, and county subsidizing that more would amount to double taxation. And County Commissioner Elaine Powell also questions whether the county should pay municipalities for the third-party study that they want conducted to assess emergency needs.
We have to invest in Medic. And if we're investing more in supplementing and what a lot of people believe double taxation, we're using dollars that would be better used building Medic.
So now what?
Well, the county manager has indicated that she's going to at least maintain funding levels. But, you know, talks still are ongoing. It seems like the chairman of the Mecklenburg County Commission, Mark Jarrell, is open to discussing a study about how to improve response times in those in the northern towns. But these talks are going to keep going. This story hasn't played itself out yet.
As we all know, prices are rising. Tariffs are looming, which will cause those prices to rise higher. The stock market is being subjected to wild gyrations and the loss of all gains made prior to Trump's inauguration, due mainly to actions being taken by or threatened by Donald Trump. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein delivered his State of the Economy speech this week in Winston-Salem and notably criticized Trump's trade policies, arguing they would raise construction costs for people rebuilding from Hurricane Helene.
If construction costs go up, let's say they go up 20%, we are going to be able to produce a proportionately fewer number of houses in reconstruction. It is just math.
So math or not, Steve, given Trump's pattern of vengeful behavior toward anyone who crosses him or presents facts that contradict his policies, is Governor Stein risking future federal help for Helene with those remarks?
I would think that with the amount of incoming fire that President Trump takes from everywhere, I'm not sure the governor's statements kind of rise to level of Trump's radar. Although Governor Stein also, in addition to criticizing the possibility of higher construction costs, he also mentioned that the president's tariffs could impact the state's agriculture industry, mm-hmm. noting that about a quarter of the state's crops are sent abroad. So, we will see whether Governor Stein gets on the president's bad list.
We bought the tracks just in case we get funding to expand rail as part of our transit plan. And this week, Joe, the Red Line took another step forward, at least as far as Davidson commissioners are concerned. What did they do?
They decided where they would like their Red Line stop to be located. It would be off Griffith Street, I believe 260 Griffith Street, to be exact. It is right near Davidson College.
So let's stick with transportation. Charlotte Douglas Airport employees pushed for higher wages and safer working conditions this week, and they called on the city, Ben, to intervene. First of all, what are they asking for exactly?
They're wanting higher wages and guaranteed sick days. As we know and we talk about, Charlotte Douglas is a huge economic engine for the city of Charlotte and for our region. Companies come here because of it. These workers saying, hey, listen, it's only fair that we get a piece of this pie, and we shouldn't have to worry about not having enough cleaning supplies to do our job. While we operate in what is a boom time for Charlotte and for the airport. So they were proposing what they're calling a Charlotte Acting for Safety and Efficiency ordinance to go before city council that would guarantee them some of those higher wages and sick days. It's worth noting this all comes as the airport's now the sixth busiest airport in the world. It's thriving, it's doing great. And I think these workers are saying, hey, we want our cut.
Yeah, and your station, WCNC, spoke with Kanye Sharpless, who works for a company contracted to clean and secure the airplanes when they come into the gates and before they depart. He says that he and those he works with are not being given the resources needed to ensure that their jobs can be done correctly, and that, he says, can cause delays.
I was getting rushed to do those planes, rushed to clean those planes, rushed to search those planes.
So what does he say is the result of not having those resources?
He says too much turnover, that they can't keep good people in these jobs. And that then is affecting turnover, which then affects when the planes get out to the tarmac and how quickly they can take off.
Sean Montgomery is an access control agent and one of the protesters on Tuesday. He emphasized to WFAE the role that ground workers play at the airport.
We're the very people that make this airport go around, regardless of whether if you want to admit it or not, regardless of whether the way that you view us, regardless of the way that you might seem that, you know, our situation isn't your problem, but our situations could end up being your problem due to mishaps and accidents.
North Carolina Congresswoman Alma Adams and former Councilman Braxton Winston, who ran unsuccessfully to be the state's labor commissioner, were both at that meeting outside of the government center this week, and they will be at Monday's city council meeting where this issue will be taken up. A different kind of protest took place in Charlotte last Saturday and in cities nationwide as part of the National Day of Action, protesting Donald Trump and his administration and its policies. Actually, there were several of these rallies in this area, Steve. How many of those rallies took place and how many people turned out?
I am not exactly certain how many specifically we had here. There were multiple rallies with large numbers of people. And I think the main thing is that, you know, when the president was inaugurated for the second time, things were very quiet compared to the same period in 2017. But since then, the resistance or the Democratic opposition has really come to life. It seems like there are protests and rallies, you know, almost constantly now. And you're starting to see that show up in the president's approval ratings, which have taken a pretty significant hit in the last 4 or 5 weeks.
Yes, yeah, some of these rallies in the local area were part of this 50501 movement, 50 protests, 50 states, one movement. And the signs that many of them carried read, quote, "They're eating the checks, they're eating the balances. Not a king, just a tyrant. Stop the war on universities and bring them home now." Of course, referring to the man sent to an El Salvador, or the men sent to an El Salvadoran prison without due process. In other words, they're protesting everything. Mary, I'm wondering, if you protest everything, is that as effective as hitting on one thing and really hitting it?
Well, there were questions after the initial protest, would they continue? And the thing is, he keeps doing things that are angering different segments. So it was Social Security and the cuts and the layoffs, but now people are making connections. So I think people are realizing if he is pulling people off the streets and, you know, sending them to this torture prison in El Salvador without due process, that that's unconstitutional, no matter what or who the person is, even if the person is in this country illegally, and could that happen to you? So as the issue comes that affects each person, they're getting out on the streets. And yes, it is reflected in the sense that also people are seeing a lot of security lapses. So there's a sense that this administration really is not on top of anything.
So one of the things that they were protesting was the lack of due process involving migrants being arrested and then sent out of the country. And on Wednesday, Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden says ICE arrested someone at the courthouse. He witnessed the arrest and spoke to ICE officials at the time. Here and on Tuesday at the courthouse in Virginia, the individuals making that arrest were not clearly identified, allegedly, as ICE agents or as law enforcement in Virginia. No one saw any identification, no badges. No one has said that they had a warrant, nor did they show a warrant. Joe, is this how this has been done prior to the Trump administration?
I think at times, yes. I think it's more in the spotlight now. Certainly, what was described to me, and I know more about the Mecklenburg County incident than the other one you referenced. What was described to me appears to have been targeted enforcement of some kind, where the ICE agents were after a specific person. But right now we don't know who that person was and if they had business at the court, if they were already tracking him. The sheriff doesn't necessarily know who this person was that was arrested. I do expect ICE to release that information, but I'm going to be curious to know if this is how ICE is going to be looking to make arrests in Mecklenburg County now, because we know that they have issues with making arrests in the jail. Will they try to get somebody at court?
Sheriff McFadden says he witnessed the arrest. He says that he talked to ICE. So we can assume that the people making those arrests in Charlotte were ICE people, ICE members. But did they have badges? Did they show identification? Did they have ICE plastered on their uniforms? Did they have a warrant? Do we know?
I don't know. I went out with ICE one time. The agents I were with all had displayed on them either ICE, or keep in mind, other agencies are helping ICE make arrests now, Homeland Security, for example. I don't know the details about these specific arresting officers. I did see a picture of the van. It was unmarked, but I don't think that's uncommon.
Okay. City Council this week did something out of character. They rejected rezoning. They rejected a rezoning petition for the Hidden Valley neighborhood. What was that petition for?
The petition was to subdivide a plot of land off of White Plains Road so they could build a second home on that plot of land. And this was in the Hidden Valley neighborhood. Neighbors were really opposed to it. And from what city council members say, the developer was unwilling or just did not engage with the neighborhood. So city council said no.
Okay. And Charlotte has seen an explosion in new apartment buildings and units being built and coming online. In fact, we have a record number of new apartments, Ben, opening in the city with rising supply. One would think that rents would go down. Have they?
You would think. That's what your class in economics taught you in high school or college. But we're come to find out it's much more complicated than that. I think about 17,000 new apartments opened in Charlotte last year, and then about 4,400 so far in the first quarter of this year. And rent is down, but rent
How
is
much?
Down by $1.
Okay.
Not
that's
quite
on
the
average.
Relief people were hoping for.
No, that's on average. Although if you move to Gastonia, you're not going to pay as much as Charlotte. And if you move to other places in the area, like Huntersville or Cornelius, I don't think that you will pay as much, correct?
Correct. Much more affordable if you're willing to do the commute.
Okay. Now, the NFL draft opening night was last night in Green Bay, the home of football, if you ask anybody from Green Bay. Anyway, the Panthers had the 8th overall selection. Is that correct? Am I right here?
Yes, number 8. And they chose wide receiver, 6'4" Teteroa McMillan out of University of Arizona. It's obvious they were trying to strengthen Bryce Young, the quarterback's, his receiving core. Many people thought they would choose a defensive player since the Panthers allowed so many points last season. We still have some more picks coming up.
Well, he set the Wildcats, Arizona, he played for Arizona. He set the Wildcats school record with 3,423 career receiving yards. He was a first-team AP All-American this year. Does that bode well?
We don't know till they get out on the field, but with that height, he is really able to get to a lot of those passes. So we'll see. Of course, they're very hopeful. Apparently, Bryce Young really wanted this pick. He really wanted to strengthen his receiving core. But they really do have to also make sure other teams don't score a lot of points.
And the NFL draft continues, and we have other picks to come. With their win against San Diego on Saturday at home, Charlotte FC moved into first place in the Eastern Conference. The Observer's Colin Cerneglia says the team is now coming into form after weeks of rotations. The roles are clearer, the spacing sharper, the team is becoming settled. And Charlotte FC is undefeated at home on a 3-game winning streak. It all bodes well for those folks. Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Ben Thompson from WCNC, Joe Bruno from WSOC, and Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.